Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 18th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I've actually run out of listener submissions now. So if you're out there and listening, and you have a story that's creepy or scary and set in or around the 1920s, or if you've written any story that involves the Cthulhu Lovecraftian mythos, please get in touch. Now on to today's menu. For the history segment, I have details of a gangster known as Fred Killer Burke. Then we'll have a piece of music by the Adrian Schubert Orchestra from 1926. And then finally, we'll finish off with a story of The Red Room, which was written by H.G. Wells. So, let's get started. The following is taken from the December 30th, 1929 edition of Time. When a big car driven by a droop-cheeked, mild-eyed man bunted another last week in St. Joseph, Michigan, Patrolman Charles Skelly told the guilty driver to come along to the police station to pay the few dollars damage. The driver yanked out an automatic, shot Officer Skelly dead, and sped away. When he smashed up his car, he used his gun to persuade motorists to give him lifts. Officers traced the police killer closely for an hour, then lost him. The wrecked car was registered in the name of Frederick Dane, owner of a commodious house on St. Joe's Lake Shore Drive. Police searched the Dane house. It was a residential fortress. Its arsenal contained two machine guns, numerous rifles, automatics, tear gas bombs, and bottles of nitroglycerin. A trap door under a rug led to a hidden room with an emergency exit. In a closet were found bonds worth $319,850, part of which were identified as loot from a recent Jefferson, Wisconsin bank robbery. Questioning Mrs. Dane, officers learned that Dane was none other than Fred Burke, alias Thomas Burchell, alias Camp, Kemp or Kemper, deadliest of the Alphonse, Scarface Al, Capone's Chicago gangsters. Chicago crime investigators rushed to St. Joseph. A microscopic comparison of scratch bullets from one of the machine guns with those found in the bodies of seven gangsters slain in the Moran Whiskey Depot last winter strengthened their conviction that Burke had led Chicago's famed St. Valentine's Day massacre. To him are attributed at least four other murders, among them the killing of Brooklyn gang King Frank Ewell. The federal government and six states want him for shootings or bank banditry. Rewards between $60,000 and $75,000, depending on the number of convictions obtained, are set on his head. The Underworld Grapevine reported that potent underworldlings would pay double that amount for his delivery to them. In full cry, detectives and gangsters deployed for a mid-continent manhunt. Searchers moved carefully, mindful of the official warnings. Burke is a very dangerous murderer. Advise police caution in approaching him. One of the most infamous ex-convicts in the U.S. The most dangerous man alive. The underworld calls Badman Burke Professor. He is a scientific felon, a specialist in safe door melting, wiretapping, hijacking, and disguises. In his St. Joseph hideout were found chemistry and metallurgy textbooks, also 200 thumb-grade detective novels with criminal blunders underlined. In St. Joseph, he was known as a retired businessman, an obliging fellow who visited sick neighbors and courted the esteem of established citizens. One neighbor recalled that Dane once even borrowed a shotgun from him to go rabbit hunting. End of article. I was inspired by this story to find out a little more about Fred Burke, and this is what I found out. He was born Thomas Kemp on a farm near Mapleton, Kansas. He ran afoul of the law at the age of 17 after being roped into a land fraud scheme by a traveling salesman who had befriended his family. Fleeing in disgrace, He cut his teeth in the underworld of Kansas City and turned up in St. Louis by the end of 1915, when he first joined up with the infamous Egan's Rats Gang. Tall and well-built, Burke was known for his ability to pose as an honest businessman. Under indictment for forgery, Burke enlisted in the U.S. Army at the beginning of World War I, serving as a tank sergeant in France. Upon his return to America, Burke was arrested in Michigan for a land fraud scheme and sentenced to a year in prison, to be followed by another in Missouri for his forgery. By early 1922, Fred Burke had rejoined the Egan's Rats, along with his best friends, all from St. Louis and World War I vets, Gus Winkler, Bob Carey, and Ray Nugent. Close-mouthed and competent, Burke and his pals were suspected of robbing a St. Louis distillery of $80,000 worth of whiskey in April 1923. Burke disguised himself as a police officer to fool the plant security guards. He also plotted and carried out the robbery of the United Railways office, the city's streetcar provider, on the 3rd of July 1923, and that heist netted him $38,000. With the imprisonment of the Egan leadership in 1924, Burke and his pals relocated to Detroit, where they began committing armed robberies and murders in the surrounding region, often at the behest of the Purple Gang. Burke was suspected of introducing the Thompson submachine gun to Detroit's underworld on March 28, 1927, when he mowed down three rival gangsters suspected of killing his friend Johnny Reed in the so-called Miller Floors Massacre. After a late 1927 falling out with the Purples, Burke and his crew relocated to Chicago, where they joined up with Al Capone's organization, establishing with them an autonomous relationship similar to the one they had formerly had with the Purple Gang. Burke and Winkler especially grew close to the Chicago crime boss, who referred to them as his American boys. Some Italian gangsters in the outfit, notably Frank Nitti and Paul Rica, allegedly resented how close Capone was to the pair. Over time, Fred Burke and his crew were suspected of robbing banks and armored cars in St. Louis, Missouri, Louisville, Kentucky, Patterson, New Jersey, Peru, Indiana, Los Angeles, California, and Toledo. The latter job, on April 16, 1928, resulted in the murder of a Toledo police officer, George Zentiara. Burke and his partners were also linked by ballistic evidence and informants to the murder of Brooklyn mob boss Frankie Yale on the 1st of July, 1928. After the murder mentioned in the Time article, Burke was named as America's most wanted man. Burke spent the rest of his criminal career on the run. He allegedly murdered a Chicago hood named Thomas Bonner at a Michigan cottage in June 1930, after Bonner had threatened to turn him into Chicago police. Fred Burke managed to elude the police for over a year until he was arrested at a farm near Green City, Missouri, on March 26, 1931. Convicted of Patrolman Skelly's murder, he died in prison of heart disease at the age of 47. And now on to our musical interlude. This is called Just Breezing Along with the Breeze by the Adrian Schubert Orchestra, which they recorded in 1926.
Like the birdies that sing living in a tree. I'm pleasing to live and living to please. The sky is the only roof I have over my head. And when I'm weary, Mother Nature makes me a bed. Oh, I'm just going along as I please. I'm breathing along with a breeze.
To the main feature. Today's story is called The Red Room and was written by the well-known author H.G. Wells and is read for us by William Kuhn.
I can assure you, said I, that it will take a very tangible ghost to frighten me. And I stood up before the fire with my glass in my hand. It is your own choosing, said the man with the withered arm and glanced at me askance. 28 years, said I have lived, and never a ghost have I seen as yet. The old woman sat staring hard into the fire, her pale eyes wide open.
Aye, she broke in, and 28 years you have lived and never seen the likes of this house, I reckon. There's a many things to see when one's still but 28.
She swayed her head slowly from side to side.
A many things to see and sorrow for.
I half suspected the old people were trying to enhance the spiritual terrors of their house by their droning insistence. I put down my empty glass on the table and looked around the room and caught a glimpse of myself, abbreviated and broadened to an impossible sturdiness, in the queer old mirror at the end of the room. Well, I said, if I see anything tonight, I shall be so much the wiser. For I come to the business with an open mind.
It's your own choosing, said the man with the withered arm once more.
I heard the sound of a stick and a shambling step on the flags in the passage outside, and the door creaked on its hinges as a second old man entered, more bent, more wrinkled, more aged even than the first. He supported himself by a single crutch, his eyes were covered by a shade, and his lower lip, half averted, hung pale and pink from his decaying yellow teeth. He made straight for an armchair on the opposite side of the table, sat down clumsily, and began to cough. The man with the withered arm gave this newcomer a short glance of positive dislike. The old woman took no notice of his arrival, but remained with her eyes fixed steadily on the fire.
"I said, it's your own choosing," said the man with a withered arm, when the coughing had ceased for a while.
"It's my own choosing," I answered.
The man with the shade became aware of my presence for the first time, and threw his head back for a moment and sideways to meet me. I caught a momentary glimpse of his eyes, small and bright and inflamed. Then he began to cough and sputter again.
"Why don't you drink?" said the man with the withered arm, pushing the beer towards him.
The man with the shade poured out a glassful with a shaky hand that splashed half as much again on the deal table. A monstrous shadow of him crouched upon the wall and mocked his action as he poured and drank. I must confess I had scarce expected these grotesque custodians. There is to my mind something inhuman in senility, something crouching and atavistic. The human qualities seem to drop from old people insensibly day by day. The three of them made me feel uncomfortable, with their gaunt silences, their bent carriage, their evident unfriendliness to me and to one another. "If," I said, "you will show me to this haunted room of yours, I will make myself comfortable there." The old man with the cough jerked his head back so suddenly that it startled me, and shot another glance of his red eyes at me from under the shade. But no one answered me. I waited a minute, glancing from one to the other. "If," I said a little louder, "if you will show me to this haunted room of yours, I will relieve you from the task of entertaining me."
"There's a candle on the slab outside the door," said the man with the withered arm, looking at my feet as he addressed me. "But if you go to the red room tonight..."
"This night of all nights," said the woman.
"You go alone."
"Very well," I answered. "And which way do I go?"
"You go along the passage for a bit," he said, "until you come to a door, and through that is a spiral staircase, and halfway up that is a landing, and another door covered with baize. Go through that and down the long corridor to the end, and the red room is on your left up the steps."
"Have I got that right?" I said, and repeated his directions. He corrected me in one particular.
"And are you really going?"
said the man with the shade, looking at me again for the third time with that queer, unnatural tilting of the face. "This night of all nights," said the woman. "It is what I came for," I said, and moved toward the door. As I did so, the old man with the shade rose and staggered round the table, so as to be closer to the others and to the fire. At the door I turned and looked at them, and saw they were all close together, dark against the firelight, staring at me over their shoulders, with an intent expression on their ancient faces. "Good night," I said, setting the door open.
"It's your own choosing," said the man with the withered arm.
I left the door wide open until the candle was well alight, and then I shut them in and walked down the chilly, echoing passage. I must confess that the oddness of these three old pensioners in whose charge her ladyship had left the castle, and the deep-toned, old-fashioned furniture of the housekeeper's room in which they foregathered, affected me in spite of my efforts to keep myself at a matter-of-fact phase. They seemed to belong to another age, an older age, an age when things spiritual were different from this of ours, less certain, an age when omens and witches were credible, and ghosts beyond denying. Their very existence was spectral, the cut of their clothing, fashions born in dead brains. The ornaments and conveniences of the room about them were ghostly, the thoughts of vanished men, which still haunted rather than participated in the world of today. But with an effort I sent such thoughts to the right about. The long, draughty, subterranean passage was chilly and dusty, and my candle flared and made the shadows cower and quiver. The echoes rang up and down the spiral staircase, and a shadow came sweeping up after me, and one fled before me into the darkness overhead. I came to the landing and stopped there for a moment, listening to a rustling that I fancied I heard. Then, satisfied of the absolute silence, I pushed open the baize-covered door and stood in the corridor. The effect was scarcely what I expected, for the moonlight, coming in by the great window on the grand staircase, picked out everything in vivid black shadow or silvery illumination. Everything was in its place. The house might have been deserted on the yesterday instead of 18 months ago. There were candles in the sockets of the sconces, and whatever dust had gathered on the carpets or upon the polished flooring was distributed so evenly as to be invisible in the moonlight. I was about to advance and stopped abruptly. A bronze group stood upon the landing, hidden from me by the corner of the wall, but its shadow fell with marvelous distinctness upon the white paneling, and gave me the impression of someone crouching to waylay me.
I stood rigid for half a minute, perhaps. Then, with my hand in the pocket that held my revolver, I advanced, only to discover a Ganymede and Eagle glistening in the moonlight. That incident for a time restored my nerve, and a porcelain Chinaman on a Buhl table, whose head rocked silently as I passed him, scarcely startled me. The door to the red room and the steps up to it were in a shadowy corner. I moved my candle from side to side in order to see clearly the nature of the recess in which I stood before opening the door. Here it was, thought I, that my predecessor was found, and the memory of that story gave me a sudden twinge of apprehension. I glanced over my shoulder at the Ganymede in the moonlight, and opened the door of the red room rather hastily, with my face half turned to the pallid silence of the landing. I entered, closed the door behind me at once, turned the key I found in the lock within, and stood with the candle held aloft, surveying the scene of my vigil, the great red room of Lorraine Castle, in which the young Duke had died. Or rather, in which he had begun his dying, for he had opened the door and fallen headlong down the steps I had just ascended. That had been the end of his vigil, of his gallant attempt to conquer the ghostly tradition of the place. And never, I thought, had apoplexy better served the ends of superstition. And there were other and older stories that clung to the room, back to the half-credible beginning of it all, the tale of a timid wife and the tragic end that came to her husband's jest of frightening her. And looking around that large, somber room, with its shadowy window bays, its recesses and alcoves, one could well understand the legends that had sprouted in its black corners, its germinating darkness. My candle was a little tongue of light in its vastness that failed to pierce the opposite end of the room and left an ocean of mystery and suggestion beyond its island of light. I resolved to make a systematic examination of the place at once and dispel the fanciful suggestions of its obscurity before they obtained a hold upon me. After satisfying myself of the fastening of the door, I began to walk about the room, peering round each article of furniture, tucking up the valances of the bed, and opening its curtains wide. I pulled up the blinds and examined the fastenings of the several windows before closing the shutters, leaned forward and looked up the blackness of the wide chimney, and tapped the dark oak paneling for any secret opening. There were two big mirrors in the room, each with a pair of sconces bearing candles, and on the mantelshelf, too, were more candles in china candlesticks. All these I lit one after the other. The fire was laid, an unexpected consideration from the old housekeeper, and I lit it to keep down any disposition to shiver, and when it was burning well, I stood round with my back to it and regarded the room again. I had pulled up a chintz-covered armchair and a table, to form a kind of barricade before me, and on this lay my revolver, ready to hand. My precise examination had done me good, but I still found the remoter darkness of the place and its perfect stillness too stimulating for the imagination. The echoing of the stir and crackling of the fire was no sort of comfort to me. The shadow in the alcove at the end in particular had that undefinable quality of a presence, that odd suggestion of a lurking, living thing, that comes so easily in silence and solitude. At last, to restore myself, I walked with a candle into it and satisfied myself that there was nothing tangible there. I stood that candle upon the floor of the alcove and left it in that position. By this time I was in a state of considerable nervous tension, although to my reason there was no adequate cause for the condition. My mind, however, was perfectly clear. I postulated quite unreservedly that nothing supernatural could happen. And to pass the time, I began to string some rhymes together, Inglesby fashion, of the original legend of the place. A few I spoke aloud, but the echoes were not pleasant. For the same reason I also abandoned, after a time, a conversation with myself upon the impossibility of ghosts and haunting. My mind reverted to the three old and distorted people downstairs, and I tried to keep it upon that topic. The somber reds and blacks of the room troubled me. Even with seven candles, the place was merely dim. The one in the alcove flared in a draught, and the fire flickering kept the shadows in penumbra perpetually shifting and stirring. Casting about for a remedy, I recalled the candles I had seen in the passage, and, with a slight effort, walked out into the moonlight, carrying a candle and leaving the door open, and presently returned with as many as 10. These I put in various knick-knacks of china with which the room was sparsely adorned, lit and placed where the shadows had lain deepest, some on the floor, some in the window recesses, until at last my 17 candles were so arranged that not an inch of the room but had the direct light of at least one of them. It occurred to me that when the ghost came, I could warn him not to trip over them. The room was now quite brightly illuminated. There was something very cheery and reassuring in these little streaming flames, and snuffing them gave me an occupation, and afforded a helpful sense of the passage of time. Even with that, however, the brooding expectation of the vigil weighed heavily upon me. It was after midnight that the candle in the alcove suddenly went out, and the black shadow sprang back to its place there. I did not see the candle go out. I simply turned and saw that the darkness was there, as one might start and see the unexpected presence of a stranger. "By Jove," said I aloud, "that draught's a strong one." And taking the matches from the table, I walked across the room in a leisurely manner to relight the corner again. My first match would not strike, and as I succeeded with the second, something seemed to blink on the wall before me. I turned my head involuntarily and saw that the two candles on the little table by the fireplace were extinguished. I rose at once to my feet. "Odd," I said. "Did I do that myself in a flash of absent-mindedness?" I walked back, relit one, and as I did so I saw the candle in the right sconce of one of the mirrors wink and go right out, and almost immediately its companion followed it. There was no mistake about it. The flame vanished as if the wicks had been suddenly nipped between a finger and a thumb, leaving the wick neither glowing nor smoking, but black. While I stood gaping, the candle at the foot of the bed went out, and the shadow seemed to take another step towards me. "This won't do," said I, and first one and then another candle on the mantel-shelf followed. "What's up?" I cried, with a queer high note getting into my voice somehow. At that the candle on the wardrobe went out, and the one I had relit in the alcove followed. "Steady on," I said. "These candles are wanted," speaking with a half-hysterical facetiousness and scratching away at a match the while for the mantel candlesticks. My hands trembled so much that twice I missed the rough paper of the matchbox. As the mantel emerged from the darkness again, two candles in the remoter end of the window were eclipsed, but with the same match I also relit the larger mirror candles and those on the floor near the doorway, so that for the moment I seemed to gain on the extinctions. But then in a volley there vanished four lights at once in different corners of the room, and I struck another match in quivering haste and stood hesitating whither to take it. As I stood undecided, an invisible hand seemed to sweep out the two candles on the table. With a cry of terror I dashed at the alcove, then into the corner, and then into the window, relighting three, as two more vanished by the fireplace. Then, perceiving a better way, I dropped the matches on the iron-bound deed-box in the corner, and caught up the bedroom candlestick. With this I avoided the delay of striking matches. But for all that, the steady process of extinction went on, and the shadows I feared and fought against returned, and crept in upon me. First a step gained on this side of me, and then on that. It was like a ragged storm-cloud sweeping out the stars. Now and then one returned for a minute and was lost again. I was now almost frantic with the horror of the coming darkness, and my self-possession deserted me. I leaped, panting and disheveled, from candle to candle in a vain struggle against that remorseless advance. I bruised myself on the thigh against the table. I sent a chair headlong. I stumbled and fell and whisked the cloth from the table in my fall. My candle rolled away from me, and I snatched another one as I rose. Abruptly this was blown out, as I swung it off the table by the wind of my sudden movement, and immediately the two remaining candles followed. But there was light still in the room, a red light that staved off the shadows from me. The fire! Of course, I could still thrust my candle between the bars and relight it. I turned to where the flames were still dancing between the glowing coals and splashing red reflections upon the furniture, made two steps toward the grate, and incontinently the flames dwindled and vanished, the glow vanished, the reflections rushed together and vanished, and as I thrust the candle between the bars, darkness closed upon me like the shutting of an eye, wrapped about me in a stifling embrace, sealed my vision, and crushed the last vestiges of reason from my brain. The candle fell from my hand. I flung out my arms in a vain effort to thrust that ponderous blackness away from me, and, lifting up my voice, screamed with all my might, once, twice, thrice. Then I think I must have staggered to my feet. I know I thought suddenly of the moonlit corridor, and, with my head bowed and my arms over my face, made a run for the door. But I had forgotten the exact position of the door, and struck myself heavily against the corner of the bed. I staggered back, turned, and was either struck or struck myself against some other bulky furniture. I have a vague memory of battering myself thus to and fro in the darkness, of a cramped struggle, and of my own wild crying as I darted to and fro, of a heavy blow at last upon my forehead, a horrible sensation of falling that lasted an age, of my last frantic effort to keep my footing, and then I remember no more. I opened my eyes in daylight. My head was roughly bandaged, and the man with the withered arm was watching my face. I looked about me, trying to remember what had happened, and for a space I could not recollect. I rolled my eyes into the corner and saw the old woman, no longer abstracted, pouring out some drops of medicine from a little blue vial into a glass. "Where am I?" I asked. "I seem to remember you, and yet I cannot remember who you are." They told me then, and I heard of the haunted red room as one who hears a tale.
"We found you at dawn," said he, "and there was blood on your forehead and lips."
It was very slowly I recovered my memory of my experience.
"You believe now," said the old man, "that the room is haunted?"
He spoke no longer as one who greets an intruder, but as one who grieves for a broken friend. "Yes," said I, "the room is haunted."
"And you have seen it, and we, who have lived here all our lives, have never set eyes upon it, because we have never dared. Tell us, is it truly the old earl who—"
"No," said I, "it is not."
"I told you so," said the old lady with the glass in her hand. "It is his poor young countess who was frightened."
"It is not," I said. "There is neither ghost of earl nor ghost of countess in that room. There is no ghost there at all. But worse, far worse."
"Well?"
they said. "The worst of all the things that haunt poor mortal man," said I, "and that is, in all its nakedness, fear that will not have light nor sound, that will not bear with reason, that deafens and darkens and overwhelms. It followed me through the corridor. It fought against me in the room." I stopped abruptly. There was an interval of silence. My hand went up to my bandages. Then the man with the shade sighed and spoke.
"That is it," said he. "I knew that was it. A power of darkness to put such a curse upon a woman. It lurks there always. You can feel it even in the daytime, even of a bright summer's day, in the hangings, in the curtains, keeping behind you however you face about. In the dust it creeps along the corridors and follows you so that you dare not turn. There is fear in that room of hers, black fear, and there will be, so long as this house of sin endures."
Thank you, William. That was wonderfully read. Remember, everybody, I'm looking for story submissions. So if you have a story, please get in touch. The email address is cthulhu@bookranger.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.